Hello, this is Deborah Kelso, host of this edition of Nature Now for the last week of February. This week, we are very pleased to have for you part two of our phone interview recorded last month with forager extraordinaire Nancy Slick, who came to speak with us about edible and medicinal plants. Part one was aired the third week in January and is up now as a podcast at kptz.org if you would like to hear the show in its entirety. Before we get to our main topic, let's first hear the mystery sound of the week. Isn't this a cool sound? We'll play it again at the end of the program and tell you what it is. Now on to the second part of our phone interview with Nancy Slick. We were hoping to focus on native plants mostly for our show, but some very choice edible plants are not technically native, but rather naturalized plants in our area. We're going to avoid speaking about the most common native edibles, however, which include most of the berry clan, you know, the salmonberries, wild strawberries, thimbleberries, blackberries, and huckleberries, because you listeners already know how delicious they are and where to find them. But seaweeds now, they're so delicious and so good for us, but how many of us know how to go out and find our own? What can you tell us about harvesting seaweed, Nancy?
Oh, seaweeds are wonderful. They are so nutritious and they're fun to collect. When I do my beach class, we always have a lot of fun running around and look what I found, look at this, look at that. People are so excited to see how many different seaweeds we have on the beaches here, especially after a storm. And if you've ever eaten seaweed salad at the Japanese restaurant, you've eaten many of the things that we have right here. So, for example, when you walk around on the beach and you see the bright green, very delicate little seaweed leaves, that's sea lettuce. And that one is edible. And we have lots and lots of kinds of kelp. And our, probably the most harvested one by foragers is called sugar kelp. And that's quite tasty. And we also have laver, which is what nori is made out of. So one of my favorites is called rockweed. And that is the one that you see on the boulders in the surf. And it's got the little forked tips. So what you can do is you can take those little forked tips and dry them out and then take a pan and put like one drop of oil in it and then put those tips in there and put a lid on it and over the heat on the stove and kind of shake it around like you used to make popcorn when we were kids, you know. And then you have these wonderful seaweed chips. And the book that I read that I got the idea from, what this fellow does is he takes his giant bowls of these to parties, and people look at the bowl askance and look at him like he's suspicious. But then they try it and they wipe out the whole bowl, and they are delicious.
Oh, so you don't, since they are already salty, you don't have to put any salt or tamari or any seasonings on them?
Very astute, Deborah, that is true. Yes, they're very salty already, and they're so good. I do want to note that if you are going to collect seaweed, that you need to get a shellfish license that does fall under that rubric. But if you are on your own beach, the DNR has told me they never, ever bother people harvesting things on their own beaches. And, of course, we want to avoid freshwater algae because of the risk of toxins.
Yeah. And didn't you also say it's best to collect samples that are still attached at the base so you know that they haven't been in the surf for a while?
Yes, that's a good point. When you walk on the beach and you see all of these seaweed samples flopping around in the surf, we don't know how long they have been detached from their holdfast, which is the structure that grips the rocks. So if you are able to get a sample that is still attached, you know that it's still alive and fresh.
And what about some of your other favorite edibles? What about for salads? I recognize we should have had you on in the spring to speak to this.
That's a great thing to eat. There are so many wonderful things that you can collect in the springtime when everything is fresh. And when I do my salad class, I bring in a box full of all of these different kinds of leaves and flowers, and people have a great time tasting all of these bits of things, dandelions, plantain, willow herb, chickweed, and Chris and bitter dock. You know, we add radicchio to our salads that we create from our produce shopping at the store, and so there's no reason not to include bitter plants that we collect wild either to broaden the palate profile of our salads. A few of the other ones are oxalis and sheep sorrel and miner's lettuce, spring beauty, lawn daisy, calendula. There are loads of plants that you can collect in the spring and either make a salad out of or enhance the salad that you have already made. I studied teachings with a Native American elder for over 20 years, and she told us that her feeling was that farms had been so over-farmed for so long that the soil has lost much of its nutritional value, and that she felt it was important to eat wild edibles to supplement nutritional needs of the body.
That's a really good point. Back to salad, you were telling me that there's a really great vinaigrette that you can make out of Oregon grape leaves when they're young, right?
Yes, yes. Any of the plants that have a lemony flavor, like Oregon grape leaves or any of the sorrels, like sheep sorrel, oxalis, can impart this lovely lemony flavor to a vinaigrette. And the Oregon grape leaves, when the leaves are very young, they haven't hardened off yet, and you could just pick them and eat them. They're very, very delicate. And a neat experiment that you can try is to make two different vinaigrettes. Make one out of the Oregon grape, but make another one out of a sorrel. And you can tell what the difference is in these different plants, but just by making the same product. And then you could do a wild edible harvest dinner with salmon and lemony-themed delicious things by harvesting some of these lemony plants.
Oh, that sounds great. Another of our favorite greens, a stinging nettle, obviously needs to be blanched first before eating and harvested with great care to avoid being stung, right?
Yeah, the nettles, I can tell you I've had a lot of intimate encounters that have been quite unpleasant.
Me too.
With our friends, the stinging nettles.
Me too, but I still collect them because they're so delicious.
They really are, and so when I collect them, I wear long sleeves and gloves that do not have a mesh backing on them because I've been stung through the back of those kinds of gloves. And I learned that if I have scissors in one hand and a box tray in the other, I can very easily collect the leaves in a container that's not going to collapse the way a bag might. If you do get stung, the best remedy out in the field is actually the juice of the leaf itself.
Well, and I didn't realize that. That's a really cool thing to know.
It is neat that the plant will cure itself. There are a lot of plants that can be used as a cooling agent, and you probably have heard people use the sporing body on the underside of the sort fern leaf or one of the dock plants. But really, all you need to do is, if you're wearing gloves anyway, you can pinch the top few leaves that have more moisture than the bottom leaves and crush them about and chew on them and put them in your palm and add a little bit of liquid to it, and then pick that up and then squeeze it so that the dark green juice drops onto the welt area. And that will help neutralize the sting.
Wow.
To do it right away, though, if you wait an hour to get around to it, don't bother.
Uh-huh. And then Benadryl is, if you've got that on hand, that's also...
Yes, or if it's severe welts. Yeah, you can make a little poultice out of that by crushing it. And then, of course, also taking it internally can help.
Uh-huh. In ferns, I've heard mixed reviews about eating fiddleheads.
Me too. And so what I did was I stuffed that up, and I learned that people used to eat the bracken fern as fiddleheads, but now they are known to be carcinogenic. So it's not recommended any longer that we eat the bracken. So the fiddlehead fern that is safe to eat in our area is the lady fern. And one of the ways that you can do that is to mark the fern during its growing season so that you can find it again next spring when the little fiddleheads appear again.
Oh, that's good to know. What edible plants come to mind that need to be cooked rather than eaten raw?
Well, of course, we talked about clover, and any of the fuzzy-leaved plants, I think, are better to cook, but that's really more of a palatability issue. We have a plant called dead nettle, and it's a really sweet little tiny plant that's purplish, and it starts out greenish, but has a lot of purple on it. The leaves are quite fuzzy, and it's perfectly edible. And it's called dead nettle because it does not have the stingers on it. You might have that popping up in your garden. I have it take over every year, but the bees love it because of the purple flower.
Uh-huh. It's also called hedge nettle, right?
No, hedge nettle is a tall plant like stinging nettles are. And that one, we have several different varieties. Cooley's hedge nettle is one that is a medicinal plant. And another part of my yard, it's one of my rescues. And it's true that the hedge nettle does not have stingers, but the one that's called dead nettle grows to be about, I don't know, 4 or 5 inches tall, 6 inches tall, depending on the growing conditions.
Oh.
But because the leaves are fuzzy, you know, you don't want to have a lot of that in your salad, right? So that is an example of one that's a good idea to cook.
Uh-huh. And we already talked about, like, elderberries, that they absolutely must be cooked
right,
before they're
mushrooms.
Eaten.
Mushrooms.
Yeah.
Chanterelles.
Well, mushrooms are, that's a whole nother show, mushrooms, the fungi show. I'm especially interested in teas. What native plants out there make good tea?
Well, I do a flight of teas class that's a lot of fun, where we have a range of teas, starting with the delicate and then moving to the more robust. And some of the more mild teas that you can make would be made out of blueberry leaves. In my case, I don't have wild blueberries in the yard, so I use my crop blueberries. But those are very, very delicate flavored leaf. And then the next one is salal, which has a little bit more flavor. And then we try the different wild blackberries and raspberries. We have, of course, both varieties that grow here natively. We have the trailing blackberry, and then the raspberries. We have the salmonberry and the thimbleberry, although I don't use the thimbleberry leaves. But you can certainly use the salmonberry leaves. And incidentally, the way to tell the difference between a blackberry and a raspberry is that when you pick the berry, the raspberry is always hollow and the blackberry always keeps the core.
Well, good trick to know.
And then so the more robust teas are in the evergreen group. So I'll make a tea out of cedar. And then the most pungent one that I make is the Douglas fir. And it's a lot of fun to go out and try these different teas that you can just pick right in your own yard.
Yes, that sounds great. So what is out there in the wintertime that would be readily harvestable?
Well, not a lot that is available in the wintertime, but if I look out the window right now, which I'm doing, there's some dandelion out there, and the sheep's sorrel still growing, and there's probably some bitter dock, and there's probably some bitter cress, and there's certainly one of the, we have several kinds of plantain, but the one with the long, slender leaves, lanceolata, does survive the winter pretty well without dying back. So those are a few that you could eat. I've noticed that, you know, usually by the winter, the blue jays have gotten all of the hazelnuts and all that kind of thing. But if you have some rose bushes, you could collect the hips from that. But that's more of a medicinal plant because of its high vitamin C content.
Uh-huh. When I read all the wonderful handouts that you sent me to help me prepare for this interview, I was reminded of all the different ways that medicinal plants can be prepared for use. They're not merely ingested. Would you please review a few of those for us?
Yeah, it's true. There are a lot of different ways that you can make medicinal plants and use them. Many of them are used internally, and others are used externally, and some are both. So some of the examples of internal uses would be infusions and decoctions. You could think of those as a tea. An infusion would be something that's more delicate, like a chamomile flower, where you don't want it to cook very long because you don't want to damage the volatile oils or other chemicals in it. Whereas a decoction would be something made out of a harder part of the plant, like the bark or something like that, or a root. And then tinctures, of course, are made to take internally. And an example of that would be chaga. That's one of the fungi that grows on the birch tree. Another example is to tincture, which is taken internally. And an example of that would be chaga, which is fungus that grows on birch trees. And the chaga has an internal portion that's brown and an external portion that's black. And the internal portion does best if you make a decoction out of it, because if you put that in alcohol, it will damage the polysaccharides that are useful. The black part, which is good for the immune system, is best extracted with alcohol. So sometimes you might see for sale a product that combines them both, but in my opinion, alcohol in it would damage the polysaccharides in the decoction that is in the blend. So that would be an example of something where if you were going to make it yourself or buy it, I would get some that is the decoction to take separately from some that is the tincture. Uh-huh. I wouldn't mix them. I don't know if that was convoluted and confusing.
Well, it's a complex subject, and I want to be sure to ask you about medicinals that are especially good for the cold and flu season, which is sadly now upon us. You were telling me about recent studies out on blue and black elderberry and how good they are to prevent flu.
Yes, this is wonderful. We've known for a long, long time that it is useful in fending off influenza, but we weren't sure why that is. And the study just came out of the University of Sydney, where they studied the phytochemicals that create the purple color in the berries. Those are anthocyanidin compounds. Those block the proteins in the virus that are involved in attachment and entry into the host cells. So if you want to prevent getting the flu, it's good to take black elderberry. But if you've already got the flu, they found that once the cell has been infected, the chemicals in the plant interfere with DNA replication. So you can get a twofold benefit just from this one berry.
Wow. But the most common species of elderberry bush that we get at our coastal low elevations is the red elderberry, right? I've heard that it can make a good wine, but it doesn't seem to have the same medicinal properties as the blue and black. Is that right?
I think that's true. I've researched it, and I haven't found really any information on any medicinal, very, very small amount of medicinal uses for the red elderberry, but nothing at a research level. So normally when I'm looking for plant studies, I look at the National Institutes of Health. So I'll type in whatever the plant is, followed by NIH, and then up will pop multiple studies that specialize to whatever the quest is for that study. And by far, most studies are done on the black elderberry. And the black elderberry is indigenous to the U.S., but it's east of the Rockies. Here we have the blue elderberry, which if you drive about, you'll find it on the sides of the road, and that does have the same medicinal properties as the black one.
Oh, that's good to know. What about other plants to boost the immune system?
My thoughts about that is that we want to boost the immune system in some cases, but in other cases, we want to attack the virus directly in some other way. So we know about echinacea, that stimulates the immune system, and that's very helpful. But then we look at, say, the elderberry, which doesn't really boost the immune system at all. It just has a direct attack on the virus itself. So I think it's important to think of these medicinal things as having mechanisms of action that might operate in different ways in the body. And that is also beneficial. It's not just about boosting the immune system.
Uh-huh.
Combining plants is also part of that. So if you were, for example, if you had the flu, you might take elderberry to help with that. But then you also might take cleavers which helps cleanse the lymph. And then you might take dandelion to help flush the body through the kidneys.
Oh, and then you were telling me about some cool poultices that can be made out of herbs, right?
Yeah, there are lots of different plants that you can use for poultices. My favorite one is comfrey. And comfrey is great for healing wounds and fractures, and it can actually cut in half the amount of time a fracture takes to heal.
Wow, and that's so just amazing.
It is really, it's astonishing. That chemical in it is allantoin that does that. So you can chop up the leaf, or you can, what I do is put it in a blender and make little wafers that I put in the freezer between wax paper so that I have them throughout the year. And you just apply that to the area, you know, tape it in place for a few hours and refresh it periodically. And that's all you do. It's very, very simple.
Wow, that's just amazing. Are there any caveats for using any of these plants? For example, if anyone's taking other medications, is there any information out there that would suggest that any of these plants counter the effects of more traditionally prescribed medicines?
Yes, and it really depends on the plant. They are really bundles of chemicals, and you think of them as drugs. So if you are taking pharmaceuticals for heart reasons, and you want to take some herbs to supplement your wellness, it's really important that you research specifically that plant and that herb with that medication. So the best way to do that, not only to do your own research, but also to talk directly with your doctor, because they have taken very seriously the extent to which people are now using these plants medicinally. It's hard to say, oh, yes, they're all like this, because they are all varied. St. John's wort interacts with many, many, many medicines. So it's important to take that seriously. If you're taking St. John's wort, that you look into what pharmaceuticals you're also taking. Some plants, like vasoexpanders, like ginkgo, or blood thinners like garlic, should not be taken for surgery, because you don't want to bleed out on the table, of course.
We're going to have you on again. And there are also a bunch of great books out there on foraging and medicinal plants. Do you have any classes coming up that, if people want to know more, that they could find you and sign up for those?
Yes, I teach in the spring, summer, and fall, and I teach at the Port Townsend Food Co-op and at the Dungeness River Audubon Center. I teach at the Wild Birds Unlimited, and they will have advertising for when those classes are. But anyone is welcome to email me directly and get on my email list. And my email address is nancyslicklaw@gmail.com. Slick is S as in San Diego, L-I-C-K, and law, because I'm a lawyer also. So you get the disclaimers when I teach.
That's great. Well, thanks so much for coming on our show and for all the great information. We have fantasies about doing another show in the spring or summer that'll be a field recording with you, wandering about looking for plants and having you describe them and their uses in the field.
I would love that.
Oh, well, I can't wait. Nora's also nodding her head.
Looking forward to it.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much, Deborah.
And here's our mystery sound again. It's a common goldeneye, a very handsome diving duck, which is a common winter visitor in our area. And I had the great treat of seeing several of them when I was walking the beach a couple of weeks ago. The sound that we played for you is the display call of the male, but I chose them this week not so much for their sound as for their behavior. I wish that I could show you a video clip of the courtship displays that they were putting on when I first saw them. The male throwing his head way back until it touched his back, with his bill tipped straight up to the sky, and then he thrusts his head forward again, kicking up water with his feet. It's quite dramatic. They are very territorial and perform other elaborate courtship displays at this time of year also. Despite their scientific species name, clangula, or screaming, common goldeneyes are usually silent. Males give a single, short, faint, peent as part of several courtship displays, and females give a large croaking gack when disturbed. When circling a lake or prospecting for nest sites, females sometimes make a series of short cook calls. In flight, goldeneye wings create a distinctive whistling sound, and that's both for common goldeneyes and barrows. They can be easily mistaken for their cousins, the barrow's goldeneye, but the male commons are more plentiful in our area and have a distinctive large round dot of white on their heads near the bill instead of a crescent shape like the barrows have, and they also have more white along their sides and backs than the barrows. And that's it for KPTZ's Nature Now for the last week of February. Thanks very much to Nancy Slick for joining us, and to our sound engineer Nora Petrich for all of her help. Thanks also to all of you for listening. Closing music is Goldeneye, sung by Tina Turner from the James Bond film of the same name. Wishing you all happy trails until we meet again.
See reflections on the water, more than darkness in the depths. See him surface and never a shadow. On the wind, I feel his breath. Golden eye.